I wrote Needlepoint in 1997, a year before I opened the Libertas bookshop. I'd always wanted to write, and in fact in my late teens, early 20s, I did try a number of short stories, and throughout my life I started books and never really got any further. Of course, I found it quite difficult because having gender problems and identity problems, it was quite hard to concentrate and focus my mind on the issues that I needed to in the book because there were so many other things going on. But in 1997 I'd already identified as lesbian. I'd made a lot of friends. The operation was well over a year behind me and I was settling into my new life. And now, frankly, I was bored. I was looking for something to do. So I decided that I was really going to have a go at writing a proper novel. First thing I did was to read lots of lesbian literature, which I enjoyed anyway. I was soaking it up. And I was really, really in love with Emma Victor in the Mary Wings novels, the ones that have got these titles of She Came Too Late and other such titles. I also liked Stoner McTavish, another of my heroes, who featured in the Sarah Dreyer novels. And I thought, well, I can write something like this. But I also knew that I could write something a bit different because one of the big influences on my early life in literature was the Biggles stories. I never actually read Biggles Flies Undone, but I read all the others. And I also read all the James Bond books, which are very, very different to the films. And they're sort of adventure stories, and putting them together with the lesbian crime genre, I thought maybe there's something here that I can do. So I set my stall out, I went on a week's course to learn about the basics of writing, and I set off to write Needlepoint. Now, although I was very happy at the time in terms of who I was still upset by the losses that I'd suffered in my transition, and in particular the loss of a marriage that had lasted 25 years. And when I started to write Needlepoint, it was fantastic therapy, really. Not that that was what it was meant to be. I suppose you write about what you know, and at the time I knew a lot about being angry and suffering loss. So inevitably, I suppose, I picked a character who was in a similar situation. And in Needlepoint, the story starts where Cameron has suffered a great loss. Her sister has died in Amsterdam 2 months earlier, and the police say it was a drugs overdose. And Cameron knows damn well that her sister would never ever have taken drugs, and that there must be some other reason why she was found with an overdose in her body. Also, she can't quite get over the loss. It's been 2 months and she still can't accept that her sister's dead. So instead of going frantic, she feels that she really has to do something to put things in perspective and try and find the reasons for the situation. So she goes to Amsterdam to investigate, really. And while she's there, she goes to the police, and the police are very, very unhelpful. They tell her it's simply a case of a drugs overdose and that her sister must have been an addict. Cameron can't accept this. The piece I'm going to read is where Cameron has just returned to Amsterdam and has been to see the police. And now she's walking into central Amsterdam to see where her sister was found. And as she does that, she thinks back to when she identified her sister's body 2 months earlier. It is a long walk across the city centre to Waterlooplein, perhaps 2 or 3 miles, but this is such an attractive city that it is a pleasant therapeutic experience, even in lousy weather. The trees that line the sides of each canal were clinging to the last remnants of their summer-like leaves. I passed one of the many male urinals and smiled as I remembered Carrie's story of the feminist protests of 1969, when local women tied up these urinals with pink ribbon and waved banners proclaiming that women had the right to pee as well. Then they bared their bums in front of the world's press and did just that, into the canal. Carrie had been there, an energetic 16-year-old who had slipped away from the school trip and made her first friends in the city. Once over Herrengracht, I turned right and made my way alongside the floating flower market, stopping next to a building where the Amsterdam Joffers had their painting studio. Carrie had taken my photo there on my first visit to the city in 1988. I was 23 and fiercely feminist. My sister, having been through the revolutionary protests and sit-ins of 70s Amsterdam, was in a more reminiscent mood. She told me the story of the Joffers, 8 early feminists who caused outrage at the turn of the century because they chose careers as professional artists, dressing in work clothes and flouting convention. Their paintings were inoffensive, but their lifestyle was not. Be yourself, live the way you want, was her message. I thought how Carrie never had any trouble being herself. Me, I still don't know who I am. But I love the flower market. It's crammed full of the most colourful and exotic flowers. Everything from strelitzas, lilies and orchids to tulips and daffodils. In summer you can buy a huge selection for just a few pounds. Today, though, all I wanted was a bunch of purple Michaelmas daisies, the simple September flower that had been Carrie's favourite. I paid the man and cradled the precious bunch in my arm. Now feeling very sombre, I left the colour and the clamour of the Bloemmarkt and made my way along Amstel towards Waterloopplein. When I saw the road bridge over the Amstel, I braced myself. Further down the main road, I could see the bleak white Stadthuis building and remembered the Sunday trip with Carrie to the flea market in the square next to it. We had bought a cheap alabaster statuette of Aphrodite or some other Greek goddess. It had only cost a few guilders, but for me it had been a treasure. I couldn't remember what had happened to it, and for a few seconds it seemed imperative that I should somehow find it again and keep it safe. I stopped and leant against the side of the bridge. The barges, neatly moored in twos, bobbed casually up and down, whilst other boats moved at a stately pace along the river. In the distance, at the Amstel sluice gates, 16 white barriers were raised like arms, as if in bleak tribute. Up above me, the gusty wind played hollow metallic tunes on the tramwires. The seagulls wheeled and dived as they were blown across the wet sky, wailing their mournful song. A police siren sounded somewhere in the city behind me. The damp iciness of the weather even seemed to penetrate my leathers, my head and face stung with the rain. Suddenly I felt very cold and very numb. I started off again, turning right at the end of the bridge and walking the few yards to where the Neue Herrengracht canal meets the River Amstel. Just here, right below me, where the canal joins the river, under the bridge, this was where Carrie's body was found. This was where my sister ended her days, dying from some unknown cocktail of drugs, drowning in the cold, grey waters of the canal. I was asked to identify the body on the Wednesday, after all the tests had been completed. Marietta stayed behind in the waiting room by choice when I went through the door into the identification room. I don't know what I expected. I suppose that years of reading detective novels and watching American cop programs had prepared me for a stark, sterile morgue with bodies in drawers. In the event, I walked into a warm, pleasant room to find my sister lying peacefully, her eyes closed as if asleep, dressed in a pretty cream gown beneath a crisp white sheet, and flanked by two large candles, which cast a soft, shimmering light over her face. I was relieved to see that there were no signs of the autopsy, no signs of any cuts. Irrationally, and for just a moment, I thought she really was sleeping, and I felt elated. But when I brushed her cheek with my hand, her skin felt cold and strange. This wasn't the same warm, soft face that I had embraced so many times in my life. And it was then that the chilling truth began to dawn on me. The body lying before me was Carrie's body, but it wasn't Carrie. Her spirit, the vibrancy that had once spilled headlong out of every pore, was gone. All that remained was a shell, nice enough to look at, but devoid of the person I had loved and cherished. My sister had truly gone. The enormity of my loss finally came home, washing over me, leaving me light-headed and faint. I sat for a few moments, recovering my composure, pushing back the tide of panic that had engulfed me. I wanted to get out into the fresh air, to be alone, to cry. But there was something else that I needed to see first. So I concentrated on breathing deeply until I felt calm. Then I lifted the sheet from her upper body and drew back the sleeves of her garment. There were 6 needle marks covering the inside of her left lower arm. All were still showing some hemorrhaging, so they were all recent, and all probably made around the same time. And 3 of the perforations showed a degree of tearing, one to a great extent. I was shocked that she could have been so careless with the needle. The bruising and the torn skin had been worse than I had ever seen. Even the most hardened users protected their veins. The lock gates opened as a barge came along the canal. I got up and began to walk along the side of the Amstel, thinking about the perforations in Carrie's arm. I may only have injected for a short time, but when I did, it was easier being right-handed to do it into my left arm. And it seemed odd that Carrie, who was left-handed, had not injected into her right arm, and that she had not taken more care. She was quite squeamish. Even an injection at the doctor's was an ordeal for her, and I was sure she wouldn't have been so rough with herself intentionally. So what could have caused the skin to tear? Movement, perhaps? Injecting in a moving vehicle? Injecting while she was drunk? Or could it be that someone else pushed the needle into her arm? Someone who didn't know she was left-handed. Someone she was struggling against. And another thing, if the police were so sure that there was no foul play, why did they request an autopsy? After she's arrived in Amsterdam, things perk up for Cameron, I'm pleased to say. That was a pretty grim passage. And there are some laughs, and she does meet people that she gets on really well with, and she does find out what happened to her sister.